Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, episode 76, Engineers Are a Tricky Lot. Hello and welcome to This Week in Law. I'm your host, Denise Howell. And we have a real treat for you here today because we've got the law professors joining us, two of them to be exact. In particular, we have Eric Goldman from Santa Clara University.
Hello.
And hello, Eric. Great to have you back on the show.
Glad to be back.
Are you back in session yet or still enjoying summer?
Yeah, we've already completed the first 3 weeks of class. We started really early this year. So yeah, things are definitely happening.
And what courses do you have this year?
This semester, I'm teaching intellectual property and internet law.
Perfect. That's what we like to talk about here, as you know. So also joining us from Southwestern University School of Law is Michael Scott. Hello, Michael.
Hello, how are you?
I'm really, really well. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Very good. No, I'm happy to be here.
So we have... yet another Southern California with us, which makes me happy since I'm here in SoCal too. We're a rarity, we people who think about tech law in Southern California,
at least.
In my neck of the woods. So it's great to have you join us, and we'll want to hear more about what you're doing at your school in that regard in a little while. But first, okay. I want to welcome Evan Brown as well back to the show. Hi, Evan.
Hello there. It's good to be here. Good to be the only non-Californian on the show today.
Yes.
Holding down the fort here in Chicago.
Good, good. No storms coming your way, I hope.
No, it's really nice. It's cooling down a little bit. Should be a good Labor Day weekend. And I think we're all going to avoid Hurricane Earl, right? This whole eastern part of the U.S. So should be good.
Yes. Wonderful. Good news on that front. All right. So let's get into it with a few tech stories. And one thing I wanted to talk about this week is this FTC story. We had it in our show notes for last week, didn't quite get to it, but it appears the FTC has finally gone after someone for running afoul of its disclosure guidelines. Eric, you had something on your blog about this. You want to bring us up to speed?
Yeah, actually, Venkat, my guest, my co-blogger, wrote the post, but it's a topic of significant interest to me personally, as well as, I think, as an intellectual question. So the FTC back in October of last year put together its final version of its endorsement testimonials guidelines. And this was designed to give us as bloggers and as people creating content some understanding about where the FTC thinks the line should be drawn in terms of disclosure of conflicts of interest, in terms of distinguishing between editorial content online and advertising. The guidelines were a mess, and it was really impossible for us to understand what they were saying. But I think it was entirely clear, and it's always been clear. You can't go around and create pretend content saying I'm X when you're really Y, as a way of trying to generate commercial interest in your products and services. The guidelines said that in October, but I don't think they changed the law on that front. I think that they just told us what we already knew. So the FTC brought its first enforcement action since it launched the guidelines, going after someone who had posted content on behalf of advertisers that was designed to pretend to be satisfied consumers. The settlement was for no money. It was, I think, best characterized as a slap on the wrist. It was the FTC's way of saying, we're watching this. We really don't like you doing this. This is the kind of stuff that we're going to prioritize for enforcement.
Michael, do you think what went on here was an exception, or we'll see more and more of the FTC coming down on these sorts of things when they become aware of them?
Well, I mean, I think this was an easy case in the sense that it was an easy case for them to take to set a precedent. The question is whether or not these guidelines are fair, or whether they're singling out bloggers for more serious treatment than other media. And this is, as I say, this is a clear case. I don't think that's a problem. But other cases involving bloggers just talking about a product or a service may be a closer question when compared to what TV announcers and radio people do all the time.
Evan, any thoughts on this one?
One thing that Venkat said in his post over on Professor Goldman's blog was kind of the paltry nature of these actual comments that these PR people wrote. They sounded more like comment spam. They were just like one or two sentence things, like saying, "Oh, this is an awesome product. Really had a great time." You would think Venkat made this observation. I thought it was poignant. You would think that if they're going to, you know, be motivated by some pecuniary interest in having these comments really resonate with people, they would have taken some time and really made them flowery and robust and all that stuff. So that's just kind of a funny aspect of how, you know, how it actually came about here.
So it was bad PR strategy just all around, not the tactics only, but the content itself.
Right. I mean, if you're going to, you know, come up with some, you know, have some plan to be nefarious, you might as well, you know, be nefarious boldly. Yeah, so they, you know, kind of just went halfway on that.
To boldly and nefariously go.
Yes.
Yes. It's always the best way. All right. Well, people are still sort of in the dark about these FTC guidelines, and we've talked about them a number of times on the show and tried to give people just some common sense ideas of how they should navigate in this world. Eric, any overarching thoughts for folks along those lines now that we have this bit further of guidance from the FTC?
I agree with both comments we didn't learn a lot from this enforcement action because it told us stuff that I think we already knew from before the guidelines. But there's a whole bunch of complexity in the guidelines that that we still are waiting for more information about. Things like, if I get a free book or a free sample, must I disclose that in my post? Or if I have some other type of conflict of interest, how much of a conflict of interest is going to require disclosure? So we're still waiting for all of that. I don't have any great thoughts about what the FTC is going to do. One other point to reinforce, though, the FTC made it clear all along that it wasn't planning to go after bloggers themselves. It was planning to go after these intermediaries like the ad agencies or the advertisers who were trying to get bloggers to do things for them. And the enforcement action confirmed that in the sense of it went after this PR agency that was representing advertisers. So, you know, once again, it's very consistent with everything we've heard from the FTC. In that sense, it's not interesting or not unusual. It leaves open all the interesting questions that we're still very anxious to get good answers on.
You might also remember that when the guidelines first came out, there was this urban legend of sorts that each violation was going to be worth $11,000. You know, it was going to subject the violator to an $11,000 penalty. I still don't know exactly where that urban myth originated, but this certainly disabuses everyone of that, because the remedy or the terms of the agreement, or the proposed agreement at least, they do not include, you know, forking over any cash, you know, on the part of the PR agency. So we at least know that's not part of it.
Well, Sybil, I would have liked Evan, just to clarify, I would have liked to see what would have happened if the defendant actually pushed this. I think it was a completely rational decision on the part of the defendant to just settle up. It was a no cash deal. So, there were only going to be hemorrhaging cash fighting the FTC. This would have, I think, been interesting to see what a court would have done with it, given some of the things that you mentioned.
Right.
But
right.
Yeah. But I think that's also the way that the FTC tends to work in these cases, where at least in the early situations, they have a tendency to settle cases on grounds that the defendant can't really reject. And then later, perhaps, go after people, start enforcing penalties and such once they have this precedent under their belt to go with.
Especially in a situation like this is such a everybody's focused on this. So we, you know, we wouldn't be talking about this PR agency. No, none of us would have ever heard of it or be talking about it today if it weren't for this. And that, to the extent that's a stigma, that's something that's certainly punitive, as much, if not more than what, you know, a notable monetary fine would have been on this one.
Right.
Had a couple of requests for clarification from the chat room. People are asking if this is just federal law or California law or any other state's law. It is federal because it emanates from the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. And also Sybil in the chat is wondering if this applies to political organizations that use bloggers as well. And I'm thinking, yes, do you all agree?
Sorry, that's why we don't take questions
from the
chat room.
Let's start from square one with that. Political organizations are governed by a whole host of separate laws about what they can do in the way of putting their word out and what sorts of disclosures they have to make. And those are a lot more detailed and separately covered than in this broad-based, you know, what you have to disclose as a blogger proclamation from the FTC. But I'm thinking that this would get swept under the same rug in addition to what political organizations already have to do. That's my guess. Mike, any thoughts?
Well, the question is whether or not a political organization's speech would be considered commercial speech, as in this case, which has a lower a threshold of protection than pure First Amendment speech, or whether it would get the full First Amendment protection, in which case the FTC might have a more difficult time going after them for violations.
Mm-hmm. Denise, if I can add to that, that's sure. Exactly right. And one of the many weaknesses of the FTC's guidelines is that they don't actually define what constitutes an ad. They just say, if it's an ad, then all these consequences. But they don't give a rigorous definition of what qualifies as an ad. So I think part of the hemming and hawing here relates to the fact we're not sure if the guidelines would extend to a political ad. It certainly would be an ad, but it might not be the kind of ad that they thought the guidelines would cover. It might, as Michael said, be the not sufficiently commercial speech. So because the guidelines don't actually define their terms, it makes it even harder for us to figure out what we think it covers.
Mm-hmm. The part where I think it gets interesting is where you move off the blogs and into more succinct chunks of communications, Twitter and other social networks and things like Foursquare, which, by the way, news alert, I'm finally on. I've been eschewing Foursquare for months now. And I don't know, I think I was listening to Gilmore Gang after last week's show and they had one of the founders on and I began to finally understand the service. And so I'm there now and I'm exploring the nuances of location-based communications. But anyway, I think that all of those short-form communications make this all really complicated. Because it's not so easy to make a disclosure in that context. And in that context, the communications feel so much less formal. You know, so if you've decided to, you want to point someone toward an item on Amazon and you simply use your affiliate account to generate a short URL to post into one of those short form services, and yet you're using your affiliate URL, so you're going to be getting some sort of commission or, you know, however the affiliate program works for that communication. It's not that straightforward to make a disclosure, and I think that people probably don't think about it very much.
To the extent that you know, it seems so much less formal, it would also seem to be in that same proportion, less of an ability to actually be misleading. We got to keep in mind that this is all, you know, for unfair trade practices and all the, you know, the things that fall under the mission of the FTC. This is the things that, you know, are to be prevented in this enforcement system here. So really, how much damage can one do in those terms, you know, in 140 characters, even if you're saying, you know, this is an awesome book, you should buy it. Is that really the kind of damage that would be contemplated under Section 5 of the Act that they know that the FTC is going to go after?
Yeah. Mike, do you think that the FTC would ever look to things like Twitter as a big problem in this regard?
Possibly. I mean, it's very hard to disclaim or disclose affiliation in 140 characters and then have a meaningful message, you know, thereafter. So it may be that these short form communication media simply don't lend themselves to the kind of disclosures that the FTC guidelines require.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, the FTC did do a follow-on announcement that was much more obscure, where they tried to clarify their position vis-a-vis Twitter. And their position is that if you were to put the characters hashtag paid ad into your Twitter or into your tweet, that would satisfy or seems to be that it would satisfy them. Of course, they don't make anything definitive. And, you know, their position is, well, look, you know, we're only taking 8 characters out of your 140. So, look, you got 132 characters left. Knock yourself out. But that still doesn't address exactly what would qualify for that hashtag. And that, you know, so many of the posts on Twitter are in the ambiguous line between editorial content and some type of promotional nature of something.
Right, because that in and of itself could be misleading if you're saying that it's a paid ad. You know, there may be some kind of something for value. You know, there may be value given other than, you know, literally being paid. So that in and of itself could be misleading, it seems.
Right. In the context of Foursquare, for example, if you're going somewhere and they've given you some kind of special offer because they've seen that you're locationally proximate to them and you go and you're, you know, happy because you got your 10% discount or what have you, and you say something glowing about the place that at least partly relates to the deal that you got, you know, that seems like something the FTC would not be concerned about, but you could probably envision situations where you were given something more for your patronage with not maybe an express agreement that you would say something positive about the vendor, but maybe with that expectation and high hope. And that kind of thing, I think, is a real gray area with all this. And the other thing I wanted to mention, too, before we get off it is, Evan, I've forgotten the name, but you were aware of a company that was filling a need in this regard.
Yes, it's a friend of mine out in New York. They have a service. It's kind of, I don't know what the status is now. My friend has actually, I think, moved on to something else, but I guess it still works. It's called Comply, CMP.ly. And the thing that I really like about it is it's a little bit like a tagging a post or some content with a Creative Commons license. You just put a link at the end, CMP.ly/1 means that, you know, you're getting paid for this to be saying what you're saying here or something like that. So it's a little system that in a very short URL format, you know, will allow you to make a disclosure in a micro format thing like Twitter.
Yeah, actually, I was just taking a look at that, and I couldn't figure out where I would fit on some of the default choices that they had. It really reinforced for me the problematic nature of trying to explain conflicts of interest and treating them as a 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. There's a lot of times there's a 2.5 or a 7, and they just didn't fit within it. And so Twitter is particularly not useful in that regard because you just don't get a chance to explain in detail all the different things that might qualify as a conflict of interest when you're posting it. And the default options I saw, I wasn't sure how I would personally use them.
Well, that's a perfect little metaphor for life and the existential, you know, problems that we have. You just don't know where to fall onto the spectrum. So it has meanings on many levels.
Mike, did I cut you off a second ago? You were going to jump in?
No. Okay. No, I'm fine. Thanks.
All righty then. Mike, why don't you tell us real quick, because I asked Eric at the beginning of the show and forgot to ask you what courses you are teaching this term at your law school.
Like Eric, I'm teaching internet law. I'm also teaching a new course on IP licensing, which is a skills-based course where they do a lot of writing of licensing terms. And the most interesting course is one, it's called Entertainment Law and Law and Internet 2.0 or Web 2.0, which is a course to teach law students how to blog.
Nice.
And they have
how does blogging come in with internet law, or I'm sorry, entertainment law exactly? What's the connection?
Well, in this semester, they have to set up their own blog, and they can basically talk about anything they want to, just to train them how to write for blogs and how to use a blogging technology. And then next semester, they're going to start an official blog for the law school that'll focus on entertainment law, and they'll be blogging on new developments and new cases and things in the entertainment law field. So they're basically going to create an online legal publication like a law review, but purely online and in a blog format.
Mm-hmm. At your school, do you see real serious battle lines drawn between the technology world and the entertainment world, living as you do right in the heart of the entertainment sector?
Yeah, I'm sort of the outlier because the school is very pro-entertainment and all the... We have an entertainment law institute, and all the board members are legal counsel from the major studios, and so I'm sort of the lone voice advocating the technology side of the debate.
And what do you think the state of that debate is? Are the two sides beginning to listen to each other and understand, or is there still just this great divide that they're shouting across?
Pretty much a great divide, I think. Mm-hmm. I could spend a lot of time talking about the problems that arise, but certainly the issues that you see in the news every day are played out in a microcosm within the walls of the school, and there's a lot of interesting debates on those issues.
And I wanted to ask the profs, too, while we have you on. I know that you guys work on very interesting stuff with your students from time to time. We had Jonathan Askin from Brooklyn Law School on last year, and he's working with the diaspora folks who are attempting to build a social network that would be open in format as opposed to closed like Facebook. And I just wanted to see if there were any projects that were going on your watch that you wanted to share with us. Mike, you want to start first?
Not really, since I'm the sort of the sole technology person here. But the Entertainment Law Institute is going to be starting a clinic, or at least they're planning to, within the next year or two, that'll focus on artists and you know, recording young recording artists and others, helping them negotiate contracts and otherwise providing them with legal services that they couldn't otherwise afford. I'm trying to extend that to computer programmers and you know, others that are in the entertainment field, but coming at it from the technology side and not from the traditional content creation side.
Well, that sounds really interesting. Eric, how about you? What's going on at Santa Clara?
So do I need to put a little... hashtag paid ad on this here.
If you're being paid, sure.
Not sure what's self-promotional here or not. I'll mention just a couple of things that we've got going on. So on November 5th, we're going to have our big academic conference on the first sale and exhaustion doctrines and IP. So we're going to talk about copyright, trademark, patent exhaustion. We'll talk about international and antitrust issues with the first sale doctrine. So pretty excited about that. It's a very hot topic, obviously. Comes up in a variety of different formats. And I think we're going to take a synthetic look at it. We're going to start with the boxes of let's just talk about copyright first sale. We're going to approach it more synthetically than that. I'm also going to mention that on March 4th, 2011, and I realize it's a ways away, but it's worth mentioning now, we're going to have our 15-year birthday party for 47 USC 230.
This is the Communications Decency Act, folks, and the provision that protects internet providers when someone comes along and leaves a comment, for example, on a blog. The blog writer isn't liable for that comment, even if something in it violates the law.
And we're going to take a very holistic look at it. We're going to talk a little bit about the history, how we got here. We're going to talk about the practice, what people are doing within the field. And we're going to talk about some of the academic literature and cutting edge thoughts about it. So it will be the largest 230 Geek Fest to date. So I'm pretty excited about that as well. I think it'll be a timely gathering for an issue that a lot of people are very interested in.
Wonderful. Well, keep us posted on that. And I finally, as long as we're talking about sort of law school and academic related things, I can't tell you, I must get at least two questions a week from listeners to this show saying, gee, I'm really interested in technology law, but I'm not sure if I really want to go to law school and if that's the best way to go. And if I am going to go to law school to pursue this, you know, what should I do? I know you have to take certain courses to pass the bar, but then what else should I be exploring? Eric, what is your advice for geeks who want to go into tech law?
This is a perennial. It's a conversation mm-hmm. that we get. In fact, we've been working on trying to develop the definitive frequently asked questions answer to this. Usually we start by trying to pull apart what people might be interested in. Are you interested in patent prosecution? Are you interested in patent litigation? Are you interested in something else? And so once we get to that, then the answer becomes clear. I think one of the problems we find is a lot of students are interested in this thing called technology law. They don't have a technical background. So much mania is directed towards the patent people. And as a result, they feel like they're not really welcome as part of the community. Somehow there's just no home for them. We try and talk to them about the different career options that people have if they don't have a technical background, which are extensive, as I think all of us on this call can testify.
Right. I don't think any of us are engineers.
What we recommend is to have people start with the intellectual property survey class as a one-stop shopping opportunity to understand just the vernacular and get a sense about the business law questions that underlie intellectual property. So once people get started with that, then I think it becomes a little bit easier to articulate the specific interest that they have in technology law, and then the conversation becomes much cleaner.
Mike, any thoughts for our listeners?
No, everything that Eric said is perfectly correct. I mean, I think one of the things for law students, whatever their interest is looking for law schools that offer things like externships or internships, not just in courts or government offices, but in corporations as well, so that they can get some practical experience, figure out what they really want to do, what they think they want to do by working either over a summer or during a semester in a tech firm in their legal department and see if that's something they really want to do in the future.
You know, one of the challenges that I remember having as a law student was not even knowing how to articulate the questions as to, you know, what it is to do, you know, to get to the path. I didn't even know what path I was on. When I went to law school, I thought I was going to do environmental law, actually. And somehow, you know, by the grace of God, I've ended up doing something like what I do, which is really wonderful. But I'm wondering if the professors, if you see that kind of deer in the headlights look that I probably exhibited 12, 13 years ago when I started law school, thinking, you know, I know that I feel passionate about having some path, but I don't even know how to find it. Do you see that at all? Or was I just sui generis in that respect?
Eric, you want to start?
No, Evan, I don't think you are unusual. I actually think that's the dominant problem that students come into school. They can't articulate why they're interested in technology law. They think it sounds cool. They may be heavy tech users, but they don't understand the legal issues, or they may not even be tech users. They just think that it might be the wave of the future. I'm still trying to figure out how to best educate students to get them from the point of zero knowledge to the point where they can start asking some of those more intelligent questions. And I'll give you an example. I was just at a reception here on campus for students who are interested in social justice law. And I mentioned, and I went there, and I don't think people would normally consider me a social justice person, but I went there because I think a lot of the things I do actually overlap. And I explained one of the projects I'm working on that fits under the intersection between technology and social justice. We're doing some work taking a closer look at the practices of medical justice, for those of you who are familiar with that. And I got a bunch of students came up to me afterwards and said, wow, I had never thought about that. I didn't even know that you could do that. And it really was a sign for me how little domain expertise students come in the door, such that they can't even think about the idea idea that there might be technology social justice overlap. So they don't even know how to phrase their interest in that. They just know that they're interested in technology, they're not interested in social justice, and then it stops right there. I think we as a law school have a lot of work to do to help students get that foundational expertise so that they can start drilling into why they're interested in it.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, that technology law and other areas of the law are converging more and more all the time, and that issues that we talk about on this show start to come up in contexts that are traditionally, you know, not at all related. Environmental law, for example, or right. Labor law.
And if you remember, you know, when we had Cory Doctorow on the mm-hmm. show, he was talking about how every company is really an IT company. What was he talking about? Even McDonald's sells fractions of cows. What was the term he used? You know, it's all just
distributing fractional cows.
Distributing fractional cows. And, you know, Kurzweil and other enthusiasts of the singularity, you know, talk about how everything really is becoming information technology. And that's, you know, the cause for all of, you know, the tremendous advances that we see across the board on all this. So that seems to really just make it a real torrent of confusion when you're trying to make sense of really how to compartmentalize and see the elements of things as far as subject matter goes these days.
Denise, if I can just piggyback on that for a moment.
Sure.
We try not to equate technology law with intellectual property law. We think intellectual property law is a key part of technology law, but we don't want people to think it's IP or nothing. But because we do that, then we don't give a really clear set of boundaries around what constitutes technology law. In some sense, once we say it's not just intellectual property, it's a bunch of other things. I think semantically, the word has no inherent limit. So I think because of the fact that we use the term as a broad umbrella, it's not surprising that it might be confusing to people trying to figure out what it means.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just thinking as we were talking about this that Cory Doctorow, when he was living in LA, was actually, I think he was teaching or a guest lecturer at USC for a bit, and that was for their Center on Public Diplomacy. So there's a lot of interesting crossover there.
Yes.
Evan, you mentioned the singularity, and I wanted to talk to Mike about his blog, which is called Singularity Law, and why it is called that and what you're exploring in that regard, Mike.
It's probably a misnomer. It was just an interesting URL that was available.
A lost student trying to find their way.
Right, you know, you're trying to find a URL that has any meaning whatsoever, and you run across something of that nature. I've always been a Kurzweil fan. Some of the posts probably have some implications or aspects to his idea of the singularity, but it's not really the focus of the blog at all.
Yes, well, we called one of our shows once, and we think of the show in general, thanks to Evan's coinage of this, as a show devoted to late pre-singularity law. So we'll delve into some more of that right now. Let's talk about these Righthaven defendants and what's going on there. Eric, can you give us the overview again? We've discussed it on the show before, but for anybody who didn't listen then.
So, as we all know, the newspaper business as it has existed to date is degrading rapidly. Lots of things are changing around it that are putting extreme financial pressure on newspapers. An organization called Righthaven has emerged that pitches newspapers on the principle that it will go and try to enforce their copyrights as a way of either extracting cash and compensation for infringement or discouraging infringement such that people will only go to the newspaper's website in order to read the content. What's been happening is Righthaven has been looking for examples of infringing content online, contacting its clients. In this case, the principal client is the Las Vegas Review Journal, saying, hey, I found an infringement. Assign the copyright to me. I'll give you a license back so you can keep doing what you're doing. Assign the copyright to me, and I'm going to go and I'm going to blast these guys. Righthaven has been very controversial for a couple of reasons. One is that they've been targeting potential infringers who are very small scale operations. They may be nonprofit organizations. They may, in fact, be non-commercial actors altogether. So we're not talking about the typical type of competitive commercial piracy that we think of as at the core of copyright. The other thing that's a little bit controversial is that they don't send takedown notices in advance. They sue first and then include a settlement offer saying, okay, now that you're in court, here's how you can get out. So they don't give the defendants a chance to fix the problem before they're in court. According to the story I read this morning, there's at least 115 lawsuits now that Righthaven has filed enforcing copyright against in these newspaper articles against people all over the country.
Yeah, that's a real interesting point there at the end, because I think people might be under the misconception under the DMCA that you're required to send a takedown notice before you institute litigation, but that's not the case, is it?
So you're not required to send a takedown notice. In fact, copyright is a strict liability tort. It means that you can be an infringer even if you didn't know that you were infringing and didn't intend to infringe. So there's no safe harbor saying, okay, when you find out that you're infringing, if you just fix it, then you're fine. Which is, I think, a very common misperception that people in the field actually have. They think, okay, I'm going to do this. If it's questionable, I'll get a notice. I'll fix it when I get the notice, and we'll all be good. And Righthaven has blown apart that common perception by showing that they'll see you in court without any notice in advance. So it's not required to give notice in general. I will add that Righthaven has apparently sued some web hosts for user-submitted copyright infringing material. And in that case, then, if the web host is otherwise qualified for the online safe harbors, then, in fact, a takedown notice would have been required under the statute.
Mm-hmm. Mike, what do you think of this Righthaven strategy?
Well, I mean, I think that they're probably right at the edge of the law, but they're not going outside of the, you know, the strictures of the copyright law. The problem with the DMCA safe harbor and the fair use defense is that their defenses, they're not something that the plaintiff has to consider before filing a lawsuit. And therefore, they don't have to send the notice. They don't have to even consider whether or not the posting was posted by the blog owner or posted by a third party, or whether it could be fair use under Section 107. They can just file the lawsuit and require the defendant to spend the money to bring those defenses up in court in a motion to dismiss. So Righthaven has enormous advantage because it is a strict liability offense that they can file these lawsuits and then basically say it's cheaper for you to settle than to defend yourself, even though you might have a valid defense.
So we've seen the RIAA do this. We've seen the independent film producers going after BitTorrent users do this. Now we've seen these Righthaven folks do this. Where is this going, Evan? Are we going to just see this flurry of copyright trolling proliferate?
It's going to porn now.
Ah.
That's where it's going.
tell us, everything goes to porn eventually,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Actually, I thought you were supposed to lead with porn, but in
yes,
any event...
Yes. Well, at least we're somewhat mid-show, but by the time we finally get to it here,
right.
It's instead of at the end. Why, how is it right. going to porn?
Well, yesterday here in the Northern District of Illinois, in here where I am in Chicago, there were three lawsuits filed, which are essentially the same lawsuit, just with different defendants, or I'm sorry, with different plaintiffs. Maybe different defendants. Who knows? Three. I can pull up. I blogged about this morning. They're all porn companies, you know, adult entertainment media companies who produce and distribute videos. Have sued a bunch of John Doe's BitTorrent users. So it really resembles the the U.S. copyright group. Litigation against, the Hurt Locker traders and all of that stuff, like that's been going on since earlier this year. But this is the first time I've seen it focused like this, using that real dragnet kind of approach to going after many, many unknown defendants for BitTorrent users, who are sharing porn. So it's just interesting to see it take this turn. If you read the complaints, I have copies of the complaints, all three of them on my blog. It's signed by just a law firm. He looks like a solo practitioner here in Chicago. Who, incidentally, it looks like I went to his website. It looks like he practices mostly family law and bankruptcy. He certainly does not hold himself out as an intellectual property lawyer on his website. I don't know him, but he's just down the street from me here. But on the civil cover sheet, like if you log into Pacer to look at this, he's calling himself something like the Copyright Media Group or something like that, which is reminiscent of how you had that organization over in the UK. I forget what they were called. But it was kind of a trade name for what they're doing. Then you've got the U.S. Copyright Group, which is just another name for the law firm that those guys are in. And so this guy seems to be branding himself in a certain way, at least in as much as you can brand yourself on a civil cover sheet in federal litigation here. So just interesting to see where this is going. Factually, it's a little bit perhaps more provocative because of the nature of the subject matter. Procedurally, it's going to be a lot the same, probably challenges to there being 100 John Does in one lawsuit. You know, is this a proper or improper joinder and all this stuff if ultimately these are all added, they're all added as real known defendants. But I just think that this, the thing that really can differentiate this from the other types of litigation that we've seen along these lines is the potential for extortionate action on the part of the plaintiff, or what you might characterize as extortionate-like, because there are probably fewer I can't think of many things about a person that he or she would want to hide from the public record than the fact that he or she, why don't we just say he, is a porn trader. So, you know, if they're going to be finding out who these people are, it seems like there would be a real incentive for settlement quick and perhaps at a premium to avoid the risk of actually having to go in and fight over this. Even if you're innocent, you don't even want to be, you know, accused of having traded porn, you know, for the fear that where there's smoke, there's fire and all that stuff. So this seems like a good opportunity for an opportunistic plaintiff's lawyer. I like to think of it by analogy. In terms of ecology, you know how certain organisms will take advantage of a particular environment. they're like bacteria, you know, organisms that live way, 20,000 feet below the ocean, you know, in hot jets. You know, they're taking advantage of certain circumstances.
Sulfuric acid, etc.
Yes. The acidophilic bacteria. That there are certain plaintiffs' lawyers that are like this, and this seems to be a perfect example of this. And it's kind of like the way Righthaven is as well. Why on earth does it make sense to sue first and then make a demand? You know, in real life, in most real litigation that we're out here doing, it makes economic sense to try to resolve it before you sue, because your ultimate goal is to resolve the dispute, not just extract money. Just like that, these are just very opportunistic actions of litigation, which you can probably at least read between the lines that I find it a little bit disdainful.
Yeah. A couple of good observations from the chat room. First, that here's an example of the porn industry being uncharacteristically late to the party and doing something on the internet. Usually they're out there way in front. And secondly, and Eric, we'll make this a question to shoot your way. If there's any sort of kind of curb against this sort of activity, you know, is there anything to prevent this kind of a strategy where you're using the law as kind of a battering ram rather than as a practical way to resolve a dispute about rights?
Yes and no. So in general, when we create a cause of action and then leech it to litigation happy folks, there's always going to be some segment of litigants who are going to be looking at it as a money grab. And so you put those people aside and say that's just the cost of setting up a set of rights in our society. Some are going to look at it as an opportunity to make money. But there has been a bunch of pushback at least against Righthaven. So a bunch of the defendants are prepared to litigate. And unless Righthaven wins and gets a good judgment and can enforce that judgment, having a bunch of defendants actually litigate against it is going to undercut its revenue opportunities. I will also note that the Electronic Frontier Foundation has decided to try and coordinate some of the actions of defendants. And so you've got now a group that knows how to litigate copyright cases and has very skilled litigators pushing back against Righthaven. And you also have the risk of public relations. So, for example, some of the lawsuits that Righthaven have brought have been against people who were friends of the Las Vegas Review-Journal. For example, a couple of the defendants have been sources to the Las Vegas Review-Journal. And that's a situation where the newspaper might be able to push some of its content back into its website and not have it proliferate throughout the web. But at the same time, there may be some losses of reputation and losses of goodwill that ultimately degrade the overall newspaper's franchise. So it's not entirely clear to me that that just going for a cash grab here will end up being either successful in the short run or will end up being a good deal for the newspapers in the long run. And so I think that helps curb some of the cash grab tendencies that we're seeing here.
So as far as the sources of the Las Vegas paper goes, does it play out kind of like, oh, I was quoted in this article, here is a copy of the article?
That's an example. In fact, one of them involved research that the source had done. And so it was all part of this research project that the source wanted to share back. Here's how another person, in this case, the newspaper, had gone through and taken a look at the research. The Las Vegas Review-Journal has since said that we don't want to be suing sources. So in theory, that won't happen again. But the fact that it happened even a couple of times is a good example of the risks of just plucking defendants out of the ether. Many of these people are people who are or should be the newspaper's friends, and they're not going to be friends after this.
Well, that's sort of the nature of copyright law, that it's broad and can be used against anybody who runs afoul of it. You know, what's the old anecdote about Russia? You just don't break the law there because you will. It's selectively enforced, I guess, is what I'm driving at there. Mike, any thoughts about this?
A couple things. I remember from law school vaguely when in my legal professions class that they talked about these old claims called champerty and barratry, where lawyers can be disciplined for basically stirring up litigation. And I don't know if those laws are still in the books and whether they would apply to this situation, but I could certainly see someone going to the Las Vegas Bar or the Nevada Bar Association and claiming that these people are violating those rules or laws if, in fact, they're still on the books. I don't know if anybody has a thought on that.
Yeah, I mean, it probably wouldn't even have to go as far as bringing out archaic notions like champerty. I mean, most... I imagine all jurisdictions. Certainly, the federal system has Rule 11, and you know all the states that I'm licensed to practice in have an equivalent where plaintiff's counsel has a duty to undertake a reasonable factual investigation before they affix their signature to the pleadings. And if you're suing people that have a relationship like a source to the paper, and you know where it's clear, you know, setting aside even the nuances of fair use and all of that stuff, it would seem like any reasonable factual investigation would include uncovering the nature of any kind of pre-existing relationship between the alleged infringer and the plaintiff, just beyond those basic standards right there.
Right. And we do have that one case in California that said that the movie studio had to consider fair use before they could file a lawsuit against somebody for infringement. I don't know how broad that might be applied in these cases, but it seems to me that there's one group of people that do have political clout, and that's the federal judges themselves. And I doubt whether these federal judges want their courtrooms clogged with these cases, because it looks bad on their statistics at the end of the year if they have all these cases filed that haven't been cleared up, because judges are viewed from the you know, their superiors by how quickly they move these cases through and get rid of them. So if the judge in Las Vegas is being flooded with these cases and they're not settling, he might have something to say about it as well.
I would imagine, yes.
That's actually a great point, Mike, that the sheer volume of the cases could actually work to Whitehaven's disadvantage, because the judges were going to see the full range of merit in the cases. Some of the cases where it's pretty solidly an infringement, and then a bunch of the cases where Whitehaven might have done its homework and all the equities come out. So the sheer volume of the cases, I think, will give judges enough information to see what's going on. And I actually think that will be to Whitehaven's detriment.
Right. And one of the benefits that Whitehaven has right now is, as a plaintiff, they get the right to file litigation in their own court, you know, their local court. But the question is whether the judges might say, since these cases are so small, it consists of one infringing act, that maybe these cases should be transferred to the court where the defendant is located. And I doubt whether Whitehaven wants to be litigating cases in, you know, 50 different federal courts around the country when they're trying to extort, you know, maybe $1,000 or $2,000 out of a settlement on these cases. And they don't want to go to the trouble of having to hire local counsel and litigate the cases in faraway jurisdictions. So a judge might decide that these cases should be transferred to the defendant's courts to get rid of them. And then, of course, Whitehaven would have to defend them in faraway places.
So Whitehaven's standard package appears to be to offer to settle for $7,500. So, you know, that's in theory their upside from each of the cases.
Right.
And
that seems inflationary since the RIAA suits.
Just yesterday, I think we got the first ruling on jurisdiction where the judge did not dismiss the case or transfer the case on jurisdictional grounds. But I'm anticipating we'll see a whole bunch more challenges on that front. I don't think Ninth Circuit jurisdictional law is all that favorable when it's a copyright infringement case. I think that's the kind of thing where even if it doesn't meet the minimum context test, there's a good risk that a court will use the effects test to pull in a remote defendant.
Right, that's true. But this may change the equation of with this flood of cases. They may rethink this.
Mm-hmm.
And here in the porn cases that have just been filed in the Northern District of Illinois, these are all the plaintiffs are all California companies, or one of them is a Hawaii corporation. I don't understand why they're here. So, you know, the Seventh Circuit has kind of sounds like a lot the same jurisprudence on personal jurisdiction as what the Ninth Circuit does, really looking to the Calder effects test. You know, then there really has to be some kind of purposeful direction of infringement into the jurisdiction. And so I really can't figure out any nexus from this point, looking at it here from the very beginning, how the plaintiffs would argue that the infringement, the harm of the infringement would have been felt here, and there was some purposeful direction that underlaid that effect that was felt here. So I think there's some confusion in front of us here before there's much resolution on these.
Right. Hey, well, you've got all the U.S. copyright cases that are being filed in the District of Columbia. Not all those defendants are there, and not all the plaintiffs are there either. So there's a question about proper jurisdiction in those cases as well.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I think this is really fascinating. It's a topic that doesn't come up much when we're talking about technology law, but it actually does come up in so many of the cases because of the ability to be anywhere via technology. That there's, you know, it gets down into sort of the procedural aspects of the case and where it's going to be fought out, but cases can live and die on those procedural aspects. You know, it's far too expensive for people to travel to faraway jurisdictions to protect their rights or sometimes to pursue them.
Right.
So this is a fascinating thing to watch and see where it goes. And it seems to me like we're just going to see more and more of it. I mean, ever since I began practicing in this area of law, jurisdiction's always been there in the background of almost every case that comes up in my practice. And, you know, you work it out one way or another, but it's always an issue. So if we got some sort of definitive change in the minimum contacts test that right. takes into account this ability to be anywhere, anytime, that would be helpful, I guess, to all the people who grapple with this.
Exactly.
I would, since we've devolved so early in the show into porn, and since we were
Denise, yes? I'm sorry, before we switch away from this topic,
yes.
I'm sorry, I got to do another plug here. I just want to mention that on this Wednesday, we're going to have a conference call to discuss the topic, can large-scale copyright enforcement save the internet business? With a special mm-hmm. guest being Steve Gibson of Right Haven. I'll also be participating as well as a in-house counsel from Gannett. I'm going to post the time and location on the chat room board, but I just wanted to mention that if anyone wants to have a chance to take a go at Steve Gibson from Right Haven, there will be a conference call opportunity to do so on Wednesday.
Wonderful. You all heard that. Get in there. All right. I was going to aim this your way, Eric, since we've got your Section 230 Geek Fest coming up. And since we've had the attorneys general of various states go after Craigslist to get rid of its adult services ads, how's Craigslist going to fare, and how does Section 230 come into this, if at all?
I'm sorry. So let's clarify. There's a bunch of different moving parts to that question. So I want to make mm-hmm. sure we're talking about the right part.
Sure.
So you're referring to the lawsuit that's currently pending in South Carolina, where Craigslist has been going after the South Carolina Attorney General for threatening them.
Actually, I'm referring to the attorneys general in 17 states banding together to go after Craigslist.
Okay. So you see my confusion, right? There's a bunch of moving parts.
There's exactly. So let's take them one at a time.
So, with respect to the attorney general enforcement, this is not new. The attorney generals have been shaking their fist at Craigslist now for years. And what's interesting is that, and I'm going to say this in air quotes, let me see if I can show this, air quotes, only 17 are still part of the party. A bunch of them have dropped off along the way, either because they've decided that they got better things to do or they've been satisfied with Craigslist's response. So I'm not sure what to make of the 17 attorney generals lining up here. I'd look at that as just a perpetuation of their ongoing angst about Craigslist. I will mention that there's been new developments in the South Carolina lawsuit. So the South Carolina attorney general was quoted making some very ominous threats against Craigslist, claiming that he was going to go and seek criminal prosecution against the entrepreneurs as well as the company for their role in prostitution. So Craigslist sued for a declaratory judgment, and the court initially tossed that. And then this week, Craigslist made a new filing, basically saying, "Judge, we keep getting all these threats, and you really ought to reconsider. We think the case is ripe for a declaratory judgment." So Craigslist is trying to turn the tables on at least the South Carolina attorney general in order to try and get them off Craigslist back. We'll see whether or not that case goes anywhere, but certainly I think Craigslist has a real point there. The rhetoric that's been directed towards them by not only from South Carolina, but generally, I think has been quite threatening.
Okay, and help us understand, for anyone not terribly familiar with the way the immunities under Section 230 work, can it provide any aid and comfort to Craigslist in this situation, or are they simply out in the cold because of the specific exceptions to Section 230?
Okay, so the idea is that Craigslist has a category that allows people to post things related to adult / erotic services. These are all user-originated postings, and therefore, on its face, it appears that Craigslist should be eligible for the immunization under 230. There's been a lot of different ways of trying to argue that Craigslist has a greater role in the process. So far, I haven't seen anything that convinces me that Craigslist doesn't qualify. Basically, this is the paradigmatic example of why we have the immunity in the first place. We don't expect websites to be liable for third-party content. So if Craigslist sets up a category, people do what they use the communications tools as you would expect them to use them, that's not Craigslist's problem. And from my perspective, the conversation kind of ends right there. It's that easy. We do have the case in Chicago that Evan can give us some local color about, where the Chicago effort to try and hold Craigslist accountable for the prostitution being advertised on site failed under 230. It didn't really strike me as all that complicated of a case. I believe that case is on appeal. So from my perspective, based on the laws that's drafted today, there's really nothing to discuss. One thing I will note, one of the exceptions to the statute, the immunity, is that it doesn't protect against federal criminal prosecutions. But whenever we see state attorney generals involved, almost invariably we're talking about prosecution under state crimes. And 230, in my opinion, very clearly preempts criminal prosecutions under state law that are predicated on third-party content.
Mike, thoughts?
No, that's right. And I mean, the question is, can they get around that exemption under 230 by going after the employees or executives of Craigslist, since they're not the posting company, they're just employees of the posting company.
And where do you think that goes?
I don't know. I was thinking Eric might have some thoughts on that.
I'm not even sure if I understand the argument. The idea is that instead of going after the company Craigslist, you go after the people who are employed by Craigslist. Yeah, 230 would apply equally to them, and in some sense, it's even a stronger case because any one employee has even less direct connections to the allegedly criminal content.
What about executives that have the authority to make decisions as to whether to allow postings or not?
At least based on the 230 jurisprudence in the civil context, we've seen zero traction on that front. When a plaintiff sues both the company and people working for the company, the people working for the company are going to get the 230 immunity if the company can get it. And in fact, they might get the immunity even if the company couldn't.
Okay. Because that's where the attorney general seem to be going, is to go after the individuals as well as the company to try to get around 230.
It's a good way to make people stressed about their personal liberty. So, I mean, it's an effective scare tactic. It might just be lawless.
Right.
Hey, Evan, from a business standpoint, why doesn't Craigslist just dump all the adult services sections or bar them and be done?
No, they make a lot of money from them. This is one of the premium services that Craigslist provides. And so it would be dumping quite a bit of revenue just down the drain for them to do this. So, and you know, that makes it, that adds a certain dimension to this that really complicates the picture a lot, because that really can twist or put a spin, I guess, on the motives of everyone involved here. And, you know, in the story that was in the notes for us to prepare for today, there was that article on CNN that talked about this, that the 17 attorneys general banding together. And it also included a piece that Amber Lynn, you know, the CNN reporter, did from earlier in the year. And this is the one where she caught up with Craig Newmark at a conference. And, you know, I've got to admit, when she, you know, called him out on this and you know, asked him to essentially disagree with her that Craigslist is not doing anything really to respond to reports of ads for that appear to be soliciting Johns, you know, for what's it called?
Prostitution.
You know, Craig Newmark does not come across looking very good in that piece at all. This is a serious problem. We can't lose sight of that in all of our intellectualizing about this and evaluating it from the perspective that we so often take here of being very tending to favor the intermediary, the role in Craigslist plays. This is a very tough problem, a very serious problem, and I can't think of many other situations that really challenge my fundamental belief in the goodness of Section 230 immunity quite like this one does, because I certainly think 230 is a wonderful thing. I think that it has been an essential element in the development of the web and the internet and the infrastructure of what we enjoy so much of today. But when it really can facilitate causing serious harm, and there are indeed things that can be done by people in the role of Craigslist to cut down on this harm, that really presents a challenge to me in my conscience, if nothing else.
Hey, Evan.
Go ahead.
Evan, I'm sorry. I actually agree with you more than I disagree on that. But your remarks have an empirical assumption baked into them, and I don't know that we've been able to empirically validate it. That Craigslist activity here are exacerbating the problem of child prostitution or human trafficking or prostitution generally. And one of the many counterbalancing forces is that law enforcement can and in fact does use the Craigslist listings to go find people engaged in illegal activity. And so it's not been entirely clear to me that that empirically society is worse off based on what Craigslist is doing. I don't know if you have any evidence to the contrary of that, but I just want to make clear that there's an empirical question there that I haven't seen satisfactorily answered to me.
Yeah, you're certainly right. And I don't have any evidence whatsoever on that. And there is a very important aspect of that countervailing force that you were talking about. When I've seen law enforcement file lawsuits against Craigslist for this kind of stuff, I've thought of it kind of like being shooting out the streetlight above the corner where prostitutes are known to hang out. You know, mm-hmm. if the streetlight's there, you'll be able to see them and be able to go and make arrests, you know, for lack of a more complicated way of saying it. With Craigslist gone or them dumping this, you know, you're taking away one avenue. It would just force these kinds of communications underground where they would be much more difficult to detect. So that I think that is a very important countervailing aspect of this factually or empirically if one were to actually undertake such an inquiry.
Yeah, what I've been thinking about the whole time we've been having this conversation is how Craigslist thunder is apt to be stolen by somebody who comes up with the brilliant Android app that, you know, is the Foursquare for prostitution. You're wandering around, you log on to your app and you see the list of whoever's available nearby you, and how that would be policed, because, you know, there's no gatekeeper for the Android store, as far as I know. And it seems like that kind of thing could proliferate rather rapidly.
Hey, Denise Spirigo, get the patent on that ASAP.
Yes, that's been my heart's desire for all my life, to be the person who came up with the prostitution mobile app.
So. And we can set the Bilski issues completely aside on that one. That would be a conversation that would go bad very quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so because we've got our two professors on with us today, I thought this was a fun story where a UCSD student and professor have come up with a solution for Google that they've tossed out there. Google gets a lot of complaints from people who don't want to show up in Street View. And, you know, other than the fact that it's kind of fun and interesting to see people wandering around in Street View, it really doesn't further Google's purported goal of simply being able to tell us where we are. So they've figured out a way to take the images of people out And you get this sort of, it's sort of a Photoshop-y kind of thing where they fill in with colors and textures from around there that look like the building where the person was standing. But you see this kind of pixelated artifacting from it. And in one picture on this article here, it's in the show notes at delicious.com/thisweekinlaw/76. You see just the person's shoes left on the street. what do you guys, Mike, what do you think of this kind of a solution to the street view privacy problem?
Well, I mean, I think if Google wanted to do something like that, they could certainly come up with a technical solution that would automatically remove people from these pictures. But the fact is, you know, at least in the U.S., there's really no privacy issue here because you're out in public, and if anybody could observe you walking down the street from their car or otherwise, the fact that they take your picture doesn't impinge upon your privacy rights. Now, that's not necessarily true in other countries like Germany and places like that where they have different views of what privacy is all about. And this idea that you might be able to see something doesn't necessarily mean that privacy rights are gone. So this might be actually more usable in European countries where their view of privacy is different from ours.
Eric, that raises a good point. I mean, Mike's absolutely right that I think Google is on solid legal ground for what it's doing here. And yet it hasn't taken steps to remove the people. And who knows, that may be because it's just easier not to, or maybe they have other motives for wanting to add more detail and interest to what's in Street View. But people's expectations around all this are not lining up with the law. There's a lot of outcry and outrage about ways that people are being viewed and found, both by Google and other services. Do you think that we're headed for some kind of change in U.S. law on this front?
Just a couple things about Google Street View. First of all, they do blur out people's faces automatically. They also blur out license plates, and I think they blur out some other text. So they're already modifying what they captured to address some of these concerns. Now, I agree with Mike. I would think it would be trivial for them if they can blur out a person's face. They could also just have something cut it out if they chose to. So Google could do that if they wanted to. They haven't shown any interest, I think, in going quite that far. And that raises, I think, a really good question. Why hasn't Google been a little bit more sensitive to some of the risks about Google Street View? I've asked that question in a number of my contacts at Google, I've never gotten a good satisfactory answer about Google's care and thought about what the implications were of basically taking a very comprehensive slice of life and throwing it up on the web and seeing what happens. I'm a little surprised that they didn't think it through to the logical consequence, or more likely, they did think it through and they just didn't care. I don't think we're seeing a radical watershed change in our social norms that would lead us to push back on this type of data capture. Again, as Mike said, it's in public, and I think at least here in the U.S., we're pretty comfortable with what's in public is in public. I think if anything, we'll see the pushback come from things like Facebook photos, where we have pictures from parties taking place behind closed doors that are being posted to the world at large. And I think those are much more difficult for us socially than what Google Street View does.
Yeah, and I agree. I think our perception of privacy and what the legal issue or what the legal doctrine is are very different. And one of the other articles that we looked at this week in preparing for the show was this Ninth Circuit decision that says that the police don't need a warrant to put a GPS device on your car.
Let's get to that. We had that come up in last week's show, and I guess there's now a split in the circuits on this. Mm-hmm. Other circuits have been saying, no, of course you need a warrant for this sort of thing. And the Ninth Circuit just very recently has said otherwise with, of course, a characteristically great dissent by Chief Judge Kaczynski. So where do we stand with that now?
Well, I mean, as far as the Ninth Circuit goes, the question is, or our argument was that if the police could follow you around in your car or other people could observe you in your car driving around. You have no expectation of privacy in the location of your vehicle as long as it's in public. So therefore, putting a GPS device on it, even though it makes it easier for the police to follow you around, does not implicate any privacy rights because essentially you have none while you're driving your car on a public street. And so that's sort of the position that the Ninth Circuit takes on this issue.
Evan, what do you think? Is the Supreme Court going to have to resolve this?
I think they should. This is one of those where this is an important issue because it's so Orwellian, and there's a very clear split in the circuits. The D.C. Circuit says one thing, and the Ninth Circuit says something, and the Seventh Circuit has said that for at least a couple of years. I brought this up on the last show. There's an opinion from Judge Posner that goes along, this reasoning goes along very much like what the Ninth Circuit's did in this recent case. And you know, Judge Kozinski just raises some great points in his, I guess it's kind of a weird procedural thing. This was his dissent on the denial for rehearing en banc. So the full panel of the Ninth Circuit didn't hear it. But Judge Kozinski just talks about, I mean, he actually mentions 1984 and how, you know, already how decimated, you know, our Fourth Amendment rights are, or maybe y'all's Fourth Amendment rights are in the Ninth Circuit. Mm-hmm. You know, dealing with the home and now, you know, inside the home, and now there's decimation to this Fourth Amendment expectation of privacy when it comes to the curtilage. And I just always try to say curtilage whenever I can on this show because it's but you know, the cops snuck onto the property and you know, under cover of darkness, and slipped the GPS device onto his car in the driveway. And so there's all those Fourth Amendment issues. And here's, you know, I have no intention of opening any Pandora's box here by bringing this up, but I think we'd be remiss in not talking about, or at least giving a nod to this notion of, or this portion of Judge Kozinski's dissent. And he made this into a social justice issue, saying about how it was discriminatory on the basis of class, because the what could be read into the ruling is that those who can afford to put a gate up in front of their driveway have that expectation of privacy, that the cops won't sneak in the middle of the night and put a GPS device on your car. But if you leave it open, you have no such expectation of privacy. That's,
you've got it up on blocks on the front, on the street in front of your house.
Yes. Or if you have a car at all. So, I mean, that maybe he was going a little bit over the top. Judge Kozinski has been known to do that. But I think it certainly is legitimate enough to at least recognize that angle of it there, that it's potentially discriminatory on the basis of class, in as much as it would give people of a certain status rights of privacy that those who don't have the means to provide those privacy protections for themselves do not have. So it was interesting reading.
Yep. Eric, what's your take on it all?
Not a lot to add. Evan and Mike have covered it well.
Yeah,
I mean, I think one of the problems we have with U.S. privacy law today is the fact that the courts view privacy as an on or off situation. There's a binary issue. You either have privacy in a particular scenario in all circumstances or in no circumstances. And I think that's part of the problem, is the courts have taken this easy view that, you know, if you don't have expectation of privacy in any scenario, then that negates your expectation of privacy in all scenarios. And I think that's wrong, but that's the way the courts have gone. And certainly the Supreme Court has gone that direction.
Right. Yeah, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but didn't want to skip the story altogether because it's just kind of fun. We talked about last week the various patent lawsuits that have been filed recently, most recently the Paul Allen ones. Of course, we've got Sun and Oracle. We've got the Oracle suit against Google, which is quite fascinating to follow along with. And I just wanted to mention Ed Burnett over at ZDNet had a funny post and some background information, I guess, about folks at Sun trying to write the most ridiculous patent and see if they could get it approved, that there was sort of an internal contest in that regard, just pointing up the folly and brokenness of the patent system. Evan, did you take a look, and what do you think of this game the engineers were playing?
That did. It reminded me of, you know, senior year in high school, you know, when you have senioritis, you know, that last few weeks of school, I was taking a creative writing course. And I just remember, having a competition with my classmates about who could just come up with the most ridiculous stories. And so that it was reminiscent of that. And if you actually click through, he put a link to his patent, you know, a link to the USPTO database where you can read the claims in that patent. And my gosh, I mean, I think I'm a reasonably intelligent person and can understand a lot of things about technology. But if you read that, it was just blathering idiocy not to diminish the intellectual effort that went through to actually come up with that technology. But, you know, it was just certifiably absurd the way it was articulated. So funny, very funny.
Profs, Eric, have you ever seen contests like this among folks at a company to try and get the silliest patent through and actually have them result in patents?
I haven't seen that. Doesn't surprise me though. Engineers are a tricky lot, but it's such a damning indictment of the entire system. It's a damning indictment of the way that companies encourage engineers to go and identify patentable inventions, and it's a damning indictment, obviously, of the patent office to treat joke patent applications as serious enough to be granted.
Yep. Mike, any quick thoughts?
Right. Well, I mean, I think it's at several levels, like Eric said. I think that part of this shows, number one, that engineers don't necessarily understand the patent strategy of the company. So things they might think are obvious or silly might actually be quite valuable to the company. Secondly, the company obviously didn't have very good control over this process. They sort of let the engineers run wild without having any guidelines to determine what should be considered potentially patentable or not, and the company should have been reviewing this technology to determine what they thought was worth getting a patent on. But as Eric says, you know, part of the problem is the patent office is granting a lot of patents on invalid inventions or invalid patents on inventions that are clearly obvious, and they don't have the controls within the patent office to properly evaluate these applications. And, you know, because of this high presumption of validity on any issued patent, even these silly patents have a large clout because they can at least threaten people that they could sue them over these patents, even if in the end the patent might be held invalid. A lot of companies don't want to go to the trouble of trying to defeat a patent and overcome this presumption of validity. So sort of there's this perfect storm of problems that are coming to a head, and this is just one example of it.
Hey, Denise.
Yes.
Just one more thought. It's one of the reasons why I hate April Fool's jokes that relate to legal issues. There's nothing that someone can do that would stretch our credibility about what's eligible for a patent if joke patents, in fact, get granted.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Right. And it makes for a good supplemental tip of the week for us, which I'm getting to here in a second. But the supplemental one, I guess, would be don't assume your engineers aren't just out there having fun at your expense. The tip of the week that I had planned on giving had to do with disclaimers, and I got an email from a listener. Let's see, let me go back to 27b/6.com is the blog, and it contains a sort of humorous tongue-in-cheek disclaimer that says the website contains material for my amusement only. You are not granted permission to access the information on this site. And if you choose to do so by viewing any of the articles, either through this page or from an external link, you agree to waive all rights, and on in sort of humorous vein. And so the tip of the week I wanted to give here was to pay attention to your website disclaimers. And Eric, I remember back when you did a blog. And that would be surface issues and very basic things that people should have on their site. Can you give us a refresher on the post that you did on that?
I'm sorry. You know what, Denise? You cut out during the key part. Could you try that question once again? I apologize about that.
Sure. Absolutely. Apologies. And thank you, Skype, for all your constant good help in that front. What I was wondering is people tend to either neglect their disclaimers or view them humorously. And there are some bare bone things that you'd want to make sure you're doing to protect yourself. And Eric, I remember you posting about that some time ago, and I wondered if you could just give us a couple of pointers there.
You have to figure out why you're forming the agreement in the first place. So, for example, are you forming the agreement because you're allowing people to publish content? Are you forming it because you're selling them something? Are you forming it because they're going to just be reading the site? And the latter one, I don't even think requires an agreement at all. So I would put that aside. But we use the agreements for a couple of purposes. We use them for granting scope of rights where license rights are moving. We use them as risk management tools to try and minimize liability. We use them to control the jurisdictional questions that we talked about earlier in this call. And then there's times where you're required to put things into your contract, or you're prohibited from putting things into your contract. So, for example, if you're running a California e-commerce site, there's specific language that you have to include about consumer protection issues. Another example is if you are trying to claim 47 USC 230 protection, it's worth noting that 47 USC 230D has mandatory language you're required to put into your user agreement that says that filtering technology is available. Or if you're trying to comply with the DMCA online safe harbors, there's mandatory language about both dealing with repeat infringers as well as identifying where notices should go. So I know that a lot of people get very upset about the length and complexity of agreements, but they're actually quite complicated in all the different reasons why people put them in place and all the different boxes that people try to check off in them.
Yeah. The viewer who sent me in the link to 27/B6 asked specifically whether this sort of "you agree to waive all rights" language would be enforceable. My take on that is no. And Mike, I'm wondering if you have any contrary or supplemental opinion on that.
No, I agree with you that, you know, there's certain duties that the law imposes upon you that you simply can't disclaim. Otherwise, every manufacturer of a product would disclaim any liability for defects or injuries caused by the product. You go on and on and on. So the law basically imposes certain duties on you that you simply cannot disclaim, whether you want to or not.
Right.
And if you remember back in 2006, there was a case called Snow versus DirecTV. From what I remember about it, I'm looking at, there's a page on the EFF site that's a summary of it. I don't think I wrote up a summary, but a guy had a website, and he had like an entry page where you had to click to agree to actually get into the site and read the content. And he, in the terms of service, he expressly forbade certain parties, like I think officials or executive or employees of DirecTV, from going in there. And I think he may have sued under this. Looks like he sued under the Stored Communications Act, and the court held that, the court tossed that case out. So that would seem to be instructive as to the enforceability of these contracts like this, in as much as this, would be a contractual type of thing. And I guess it would be, right? If you're waiving rights, there's got to be some kind of contract by which you're doing that. So that would be instructive as well, I would believe. It's what I thought of when I read that disclaimer.
Yeah.
If I can just add to that, there was another case that was on us, not a particularly high-profile case, involving the plaintiff Shell, that had a pop-up window when people would log into the site with a whole bunch of garbagey legalese in it. And that didn't fare so well either in court.
Oh, that's right. She was the one involved with litigation over the Internet Archive, right?
Yes.
District of California. I remember that. Good stuff.
Yes, and thank you for that. So I've got a resource of the week for us too, and that is an article over at law.com by Bob Ambrogi titled Legal Blogs Are Dead, Long Live Legal Blogs. And it's a roundup of 15 new legal blogs that prove the blogosphere is alive and kicking. So although we certainly enjoy you listening to and watching this podcast, don't forget that there are great legal blogs out there. And Bob has rounded up 15. And we are blessed to have authors of three such having joined us today. I really appreciate having you all on the show. Eric, tell us where folks can find your wonderful legal blog.
Blog.ericgoldman.org. And I also post to Twitter at twitter.com/Eric Goldman.
Thank you so much. Keep up the great work. And I hope to have you back on the show again soon.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
All right. And Mike, you have multiple Twitter accounts, and they're all worth subscribing to, I should point out to people. Over on Twitter, we can find you at Internet Law, Privacy Law, Law Prof, and Copyright Law. Is that right? Any I've left out?
I have one on Transform Underlying Media that focuses on the legal implications of how media is being transformed from, you know, print and audio and such to internet to digits, and there's a lot of interesting articles that are being written on that I point to.
Great, and I really appreciate that. I love following your Twitter streams because you always put cutting edge and very interesting stuff in there. So thank you for that, and thank you for your blog at singularitylaw.com, and thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you. It was a great pleasure.
A pleasure to you as well. And since we're geolocationally not very far, hopefully one day we could actually meet in person. That would be fun.
I'd like to do that, yeah.
Yeah, me too. Evan, thanks so much for joining us again.
Well, thanks for having me. This was just an awesome show, don't you think? This was,
I know. I took notes. Did you?
Yes. Learned a lot.
Yes. And fortunately, there won't be a quiz.
Good.
folks can find Evan at internetcases.com and internetcases on Twitter. And please go and do that right now. And have fun checking out all the links in our show notes until we see you next week live at 11 Pacific, 2 Eastern at live.twit.tv. And until then, that's it for This Week in Law. Thanks so much.